Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hi, thanks for joining us in the Technology Management Program here at UCSB. This is our second annual Innovation Day. We've had some outstanding comments and discussion this afternoon, and hopefully we'll be able to connect with some of you folks next year. But we've got a tremendous presenter coming up, and I am delighted to have an introduction by Michael Pfau. Michael and his firm, Riker Pfau, have been supporters of this program for, 10 years now, Michael? So I want to thank Michael, and we're honored to have him do the introduction of Dr. Juma. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you, and thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be out here this evening, and it's a real honor to introduce our evening speaker, Dr. Celestis Juma. I think he's a man that you will find whose intellect and experience and the value of his thoughts are matched only by the heartiness of his laugh. Dr. Juma is currently Director of Science, Technology, and Globalization at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Among the notches on his resume are having served, he's a former Executive Secretary of the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. He participated in the National Academy of Engineering's selection of the Grand Challenges for Engineering. I'd like to offer a few thoughts on that, including solving the battery problem we have. He's a lead author of Innovation, Applying Knowledge and Development, and is an editor of both the International Journal of Technology and Globalization and the International Journal of Biotechnology. Dr. Juma hails from the Bunyala district of Kenya, which I understand to be a poor and developing region, and as such clearly values the role of education in the development of any area. He keenly understands the extent to which an area can develop from being connected to the wider digital world. And toward that end, he is a co-founder of the Victoria Institute of Science and Technology, which is really a necessary element of the infrastructure you need to build when trying to tie an area to the rest of the world digitally, because it's not enough simply to lay the lines, the dark fiber that will connect you. You need people to know what to do once it's installed, and in effect, to go out and train the trainers who will teach a population to make use of that. He will speak to us this evening on the topic of entrepreneurship in developing countries in an age of technological abundance. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Celestis Juma.
Thank you for the generous introduction, and thank you, Bill, for having me back here again. I was here a year ago, and I thought that maybe the best thing for me to do tonight is just to give you an update of what has happened in Africa in the last year or so in terms of the integration of the continent into the global economy. I wanted to frame this talk in the context of the advantages of latecomers. I wanted to argue that latecomer economies have huge potential to not just leapfrog, but to learn from their predecessors and the ability to avoid mistakes that have been made by the predecessors by learning from them. And I also wanted to at least take the opportunity to emphasize the simple idea that front runners establish technological systems which subsequently turn out to be the albatross around their necks, in that they cannot transform those technological systems quickly enough because of the power of incumbency. And this basically creates new opportunities for innovators in the industrialized countries to start creating partnerships with the latecomers in the developing countries. And I wanted to use the case of Africa to demonstrate the potential in this field. I deliberately use the term, this metaphor of rebooting, to try to underscore the important role that new knowledge plays in the global economy. And I also wanted to stress the simple fact that the existence of new knowledge does not automatically translate into prosperity, that it takes a certain degree of effort, almost in the same way as you kind of reboot your computers, and in some cases, in fact, not just rebooting computers, but creating new economic systems, new governance structures to accommodate emerging technologies. Many of the developing countries are fully aware of the fact that over time, economies have changed and transformed themselves through waves of innovation. Many of these waves of innovation have been associated with significant investments in infrastructure, as you can see, with the first wave being associated with water power, steam engine, electricity, the petrochemical industry, and this is really the automobile industry that really drove the previous wave. And many of us believe that most of the economic prosperity that we enjoy today is driven largely by the ICT revolution. And many of us also believe that the next wave will have to take into consideration the significant role that ecological considerations play in our choice of technologies. It's going to be essentially a green wave of innovation. What is particularly important in all these cases is the central role that infrastructure plays, whether you're talking about steam power, electricity, and the telecommunications industry. And infrastructure is particularly important because it's the locus around which technological competence builds up, industries emerge around infrastructure investments. And if you start, the area I'm particularly interested in is the area of high-speed internet driven by fiber optic cables. It's particularly instructive that one of the Nobel winners this year is a professor who did really fundamental work in establishing the ability to transmit data through fiber optic cables. This is a kind of a recognition of the powerful role that fiber optics have played in the last decade or so. I wanted to just get back quickly to Africa, which is a continent we rarely think about when we are discussing the potential role that new technologies play in economic transformation, probably the last frontier of technological innovation in the world. It's a fairly big place. When I talk to friends of mine about Africa, and they quickly point out that it has 53 countries, the US has 50 states, therefore it's probably the same size as the United States. Until you start to look at the geography of the continent, you can fit the US in there, China, Western Europe, India, Argentina, and actually have enough room to sneak in England. So it's actually a fairly big place. Or if you don't have the time to remember all those countries, it's basically three times the size of the United States. So it's a place where you can only have a significant impact on economic transformation if you also think seriously about scale. Building a few schools or a few wells in one place is actually not sufficient. You have to define it as a movement so that you do it on a large scale. Otherwise, it won't have much impact in transforming the lives of the people we all wish to see improved. It's also characterized by very poor infrastructure networks, whether you're looking at railroads or power transmission cables or primary roads. You have more secondary roads, but anybody who is traveling Africa will appreciate the fact that a large part of the time, many of these second roads are basically impassable or non-existent or inadequate. The one area that has expanded fairly rapidly recently is the area of telecoms, especially the mobile phones. And mobile phones have expanded rapidly, partly because they're their own infrastructure. They're not dependent on extensive infrastructure provided by railroads or others or airports and other forms of infrastructure. And Africans are now starting to pick their friends, largely based on the extent to which they recognize the significant role that infrastructure plays in development. There's a great association now between African leaders and China, because China is particularly interested in supporting infrastructure projects. This is an Actually, I didn't fall off. I just disabled it. Is this better than? Should I go back and start all over again? the area that I'm interested in is many of the decisions adopted to facilitate economic transformation in Africa were really made at a time when most people thought of access to technology as a scarce, or thought of technology as a scarce resource. And so a large part of the debate on how you develop Africa and other regions, poor regions of the world, were guided by the view that you needed to work really hard to have access to technological knowledge. And so a large part of the debate got focused on what people thought were the barriers to access to technology. So you hear a lot about the impact of intellectual property rights on the ability of developing countries or African countries to have access to new technologies. The idea here has always been that technological knowledge has been a scarce resource. My claim is actually that, to the contrary, we live in a new age where this is an abundant resource, and the challenge for the emerging nations of the world is figuring out how to manage abundance as opposed to figuring out how to manage scarcity, which is the way they have always thought about this. And if you're thinking about development as the management of scarce resources, economists start to play a much bigger role, because economics is defined as the study of the allocation of scarce resources. In this case, I'm thinking of this as access and management of abundant scientific and technological knowledge. Therefore, I believe that engineers, scientists, and business people actually have a much more important role to play in defining economic futures, because those professions think about existing opportunities, how to take advantage of those opportunities and translate them into good services and ideas. And this is not necessarily a controversial issue, but it changes the way we think about who should be the primary advisor, say, to leaders of emerging nations on economic opportunities. You need people who understand technological trends, who are aware of the fact that we live in a world of technological abundance, and can think about how you harness opportunities. So there are people who would necessarily think entrepreneurially, as opposed to the classical way of thinking about knowledge as a scarce resource. There are colleagues of mine who I've worked with who claim that scientific and technical knowledge doubles every 14 months if you use traditional indicators like citations in literature or a filing of patents. It's basically growing exponentially. And this is also linked to the margins of significant contributors to the Global Fund of Scientific and Technical Knowledge, like China, India, Brazil, and other newly industrialized countries. So we live in a world that is radically different from, say, the world of the world we lived in, say, 50 years ago. We have new sources of knowledge. For example, there are over 880 satellites in space that are operating at the moment, a large number of them beaming down to Earth large quantities of scientific and technical information. That is basically, is not included in the so-called 14, the doubling of knowledge in every 14 months. This is just large amounts of data, a lot of which is collected for security purposes, and therefore not adequately put into economic utility. Again, the expansion of capabilities, processing capabilities, particularly in the area of computing, the famous Moore's law, and the shortening of time frames between research and deployment of products. In that today, when you hear about a rumor about a product, within months, that product is in the marketplace. Generations ago, families labored all their lives improving very simple technologies. And as a consequence, many people started to be very skeptical about whether technologies have any impact on human lives, because it took so long to get products from research to commercialization. Today we have a lot more instruments that help us, incentives that help us to move from research to commercialization actually fairly quickly. And a large part of this is essentially the phenomena of technological abundance, in that more knowledge is just available. And we are all networked. We operate now in a global economy where scientists are and engineers are connected worldwide. And therefore, the possibilities of getting together and solving technical problems have been significantly expanded by our global connectivity and mobility of individuals, the diasporas of various countries. My apologies to any people in the audience of Irish origin. This is not unique to the Irish. Almost every nation in the world today has its diasporas who contribute not only to the in the countries where they are located, but also back in their countries of origin. So again, this reinforces not just the view that we have more knowledge available, but this knowledge is also networked and more readily accessible because of advances in communications technologies. Let me just give a couple of examples. The mobile phones in Africa are a good example of this. When we call them mobile, not because we carry them in our pockets, this is what most people think. The first mobile phone developed by Ericsson in 1956 weighed 42 kilos. And the reason they called it a mobile telephone, A, was because for the first time you could actually communicate with somebody else without being physically connected. And this was, nobody thought this would become available for the general public. You needed a car to carry it around. But very rapidly, because of the phenomenon of advances in technological knowledge, started to see process of improvement, rapid improvement. Car phones, Motorola's car phones were, I don't know if there's anybody here old enough to have owned one, but this was considered a significant breakthrough in terms of miniaturization of the telephone. And it took Martin Cooper at Motorola 10 years. He had this conviction that this technology really should be available to the general public so that people can carry it around. This is Dynatac, a telephone that was released in 1983 that weighed about 2 kilos and cost $2,000. And most people thought it couldn't be afforded by anybody. And I remember a few years after that arguing that looking at the trends over the invention of the first mobile telephone, that we are going to experience even further miniaturization, improvement in efficiency and functionality, and that these technologies would become available to a lot of people in the developing world. And I was told by my colleagues, particularly in the economics profession, that this is basically wishful thinking. They consider these telephones to be basically status symbols that were available only to the rich, and people joked about them. They called it the brick because it was actually quite heavy. And when mobile phones got to Africa, people got very creative in figuring out how to create new networks. If you look very carefully, there's a guy up here actually coming down from making a phone call. This image was provided to me by the president of Vodacom Congo, who established the largest cell phone company in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And this is not a site you see very often. This photograph has now become a collector's item. But just pay tribute to the creativity of the people. Very quickly, Africans started to think of new ways by which they could leverage the capacity in mobile phones to think of new businesses that didn't exist before. This is one of the first examples I have found of a new business associated with a mobile phone. This gentleman was actually selling rubber bands. And it is evident that there must have been a market of people who really wanted to be literally connected to to their friends and colleagues. I I've now established without doubt that this photograph was taken in Ethiopia. There have been some debates on where it was actually taken. I think of it as the first application of Bluetooth. Much more seriously, we now have a new industry, which is mobile banking, which is the ability to basically transmit money using cell phones. It's the fastest growing industry in East Africa at the moment. It grew out of Kenya with people, first of all, knowing that you could transfer airtime from one mobile phone to another. And somebody cleverly said, if you could transfer airtime from one mobile phone to another, and you've spent money buying that airtime, why not define that airtime as a currency? And so you can now go to a kiosk, buy airtime under this system, the so-called M-Pesa. M-Pesa means mobile money. M-Pesa means money in Kiswahili. And transmit to somebody else who will go to a kiosk and sell back the airtime to the kiosk and get money. This is it now has something like 8 million subscribers. It was launched in 2007. It's a major industry. In fact, last week it went international. You can now transmit in money using this system from Kenya to other countries. And there's been a major debate on whether telephone companies should now be regulated in the same way you regulate banks, because you start to see this convergence between banking and mobile telephony, something that's come out of Africa. Mobile banking is going to become a global phenomenon. And this is an idea that has grown out of Africa because of just the creativity of the people trying to solve one critical problem, which is banks are very expensive, they are slow, very bureaucratic. And you don't have to open a bank account to actually use the system. It's a very straightforward mechanism. And this has been done using regular cell phones with a narrow bandwidth. The question is, what could you do if you had broadband? That's the issue that I've been interested in, looking at the potential for expansion of broadband capabilities on the continent. Only about 1% of the global broadband market is sold in Africa. So it's really another example of a latecomer economy. Most of it is because of very slow speeds. They use satellites. There hasn't been, until recently, the possibility to expand access to broadband using undersea fiber optic cables, which is starting to happen. As of June of last year, this is how the world looked like, with a large part of Africa being totally isolated and relying almost entirely on access to satellites which are very slow and expensive. This is, again, going back to my theme of technological abundance and reduction in prices. Africa is able to do this now because of major reduction in the price of laying fiber optic cables. This is roughly one-tenth, actually less than one-tenth, of what it cost only a decade ago to lay fiber optic cables. And so this is what the continent looks like at the moment, with the first major investment. Until recently, we had one cable called SAT-3, which was laid on the west coast of Africa, that basically operated on a very standard business model, which is charged very highly to a few consumers. And so its capacity utilization was roughly 5%, and people hardly got access to it. And other people have come in taking advantage of the low cost of laying fiber optic cables and decided to basically, a company called Seacom has been the pioneer in this by laying a cable from South Africa through the Red Sea to Europe. Another company called Glod One has already landed its cable in Nigeria. And the rest of them are essentially proposals. The only other one that is working is this small link here, which is called, it's a service called the Lion. I don't know why they thought of calling it the Lion. It's not very threatening, but that's the name of the service. By most of these proposals are expected to come on stream in 2011. So work is underway. So we are looking at a continent that's going to be radically transformed in terms of its connectivity to the global community over a very short period. I can't think of any other region of the world where connectivity has taken place that quickly. And with a basically massive investment and in infrastructure, a lot of it, in fact, generated locally. CECOM's investment structure basically involves 75% being sourced locally. Basically, the countries along the coast are the sources of the majority of the shareholding in the company. Only about 25% is accounted for by French, Indian, and to some extent, U.S. investment. It's a very unique and very interesting business model, which is kind of a collaborative business model. It's a $600 million investment. It's probably the largest and most significant infrastructure investment in the eastern coast of Africa since the construction of colonial railways. So not very much has happened in the domain of infrastructure in that region. It's been driven by wanting to meet the deadlines of the World Cup in South Africa, which is an area I would never have thought of, that the timetable for the World Bank, for the World Cup, would be the driving force for getting Africa to modernize its infrastructure. Because if that infrastructure doesn't exist, it would be very, very difficult to host the World Cup in South Africa. It's one of the key requirements to host the World Cup is to have the connectivity so that people who cannot get there can actually watch watch the game. In addition to the undersea cables, Google and a group of partners has launched the so-called OB3, the other 3 billion. This is based on an observation made by Google that about 3 billion people who live largely in the tropics have very limited access to high-speed internet, and the costs of getting these cables to them is actually very difficult. Secondly, a large part of the interior of Africa is characterized by very, very rough terrain, so it is going to be very expensive to get fiber optic cables to most of the interior of Africa. And so the idea is basically to launch 16 satellites in orbit, of which each of those satellites will have 10 antennas, and each of those antennas will have a footprint of about 500 miles. And the expectation is that they would essentially cover most of the tropical region. And because it's based on a satellite access, they don't have to essentially to come and do surveys. You just need to give them coordinates. And they will start launching these satellites in 2010. So if you think of the combination of this capacity with undersea fiber optic cables, it gives you an idea of very dramatic opportunities in Africa for creating new businesses. And that's what I wanted to talk a little bit about. First, just some key standard markets. The first being a recognition on the part of the Africans themselves that to take advantage of these possibilities and opportunities, they need to move away from having these 53 different markets, small countries operating on their own, to actually creating trading blocks. This is the idea of regional integration, and the most advanced of this is the so-called the common market for Eastern and Southern Africa, which includes 20 African countries, starting with, in Zimbabwe, including Madagascar and some of the island states, and now covers Libya and Egypt, which are hardly in Eastern and Southern Africa. And it's become so attractive that countries that are not on the African continent are now asking to become members of that common market. Yemen has applied to be considered a member of that common market. And when somebody pointed out that Yemen was not in Africa, the Yemenis said, we'll build a bridge across the Red Sea, and that will connect us to the continent. The other is basically a shift from standard call centers, which is emerging in Africa at the moment, to really more serious business outsourcing arrangements because of the existence of broadband. And many companies are now starting to take advantage of this. African countries are also creating policies that enable them to attract investments in the business outsourcing. The other area that is very significant is the area of access devices, mostly computers. Scenes like this will disappear on the continent as people move towards basically abandon these diverse devices and take advantage of technological convergence that is occurring at the moment. So what we are likely to see is an Africa which won't have desktops anymore, because they go straight into mobile broadband. This is another aspect of technological leapfrogging with the rapid deployment and commercialization of the so-called netbooks. And this is most analysts in industry expect that this is the scene we're going to see in Africa, with actually these netbooks getting even smaller and smaller. And there are now debates on whether it's going to be cell phones functioning like computers, or computers will start functioning like cell phones. We don't know exactly what character it will take, but what we know for sure is that people will have one device rather than several devices or many devices. With the obvious major trends, the expansion of trade in netbooks. The other area is the area of content development, and this will happen in two ways. One is Africans will start having access to content developed elsewhere, especially educational content, as more universities start to make their educational material available. And the parallel to that is going to be the commercialization of content generated in Africa, which is already we're starting to see the emergence of small startup companies in Eastern Africa that are working on animation, and in fact entering into contractual arrangements with major film producers to start creating animation based on African idioms. This is all taking place in essential already in anticipation of the continent being connected to high-speed internet. The third area is the area of applications. Already a number of small startup companies in Kenya that have been making apps for Apple. And the final area is with the reduction in the price of storage. There's a lot of excitement about cloud computing. This is significant because it's also going to take advantage of the emergence of the netbooks, in that you don't have to have a fancy, expensive laptop if you can actually create basically cloud computing industry as the starting point. So these countries are going to leap straight into cloud computing and take advantage of the existence of low-cost access devices, basically the netbooks. And my projection is that within a short time, maybe in the next 5 years, service providers in Africa will be giving away some of these netbooks for free, because they're going to be so cheap that it won't make sense for them to actually sell them. Just in the same way that telephone companies in the U.S. are already starting to give away netbooks for free, this is going to happen in Africa. Let me give you just a few examples of where I envisage major developments to take place. The first is the area of the so-called mobile education, of which the so-called the Exo laptop. This is produced by the One Laptop, a Child Foundation. I serve on the board of directors of this organization, so my views on this are totally biased, and they're biased in the right direction. This is really an example of the contributions of technological abundance. It took us about 2 years to develop this laptop. We're involving about 500 engineers worldwide. This would not have been possible if we didn't have this global connectivity. Secondly, we took advantage of the emergence of flash memory as a way to design a new computer platform. So it doesn't have moving parts. And because it doesn't have moving parts, it's highly ruggedized, which is what you need for children. So children have no problems, no worries about dropping it. It won't break. So I like to throw it around. You can throw it around. Don't do that to your regular laptops, for example. Now, the good news is that children don't like throwing these laptops around because they really value them. But I just to show what is possible because of just advances in technology and what can happen actually within a very, very short period. We are working on a second version of this, which will be basically a touch screen. We get rid of the keyboard. The current one, the battery lasts about 7 hours. The next generation will have a battery that lasts about 40 hours. And the potential for expanding basically educational opportunities if you have a battery that lasts 40 hours. In fact, it's not the battery. The improvements are in the display, in that we have major advances in the display technology have made it now possible to have much more efficient laptops. They are now widely distributed. This is Uruguay, which made a decision to provide every child in primary schools in Uruguay the laptop. It's the most developed area in terms of the application of this technology. We are now bundling it with educational content, which means that these countries won't have to buy textbooks. They can go straight into digital material. We set up our learning center. We moved it from Cambridge, from MIT. It's now located in Rwanda to try to basically move this technology to Africa. This was actually at the airport in Rwanda, where it's the only place. This was taken about a year ago, which is the only place you could have free access to Wi-Fi. So kids go there, not to watch the airplanes, but actually to have access to the internet. We have a very small market in the Vatican. And my hope, I'm a Catholic, I have to confess this, my hope is that this market will actually grow at some point. This was a colleague of ours from the Brazilian Academy of Sciences who assured us that he would get at least a sample to the Pope. And if you look very carefully, the Pope is actually fairly excited about about the laptop. This was taken, I believe, this was done about October of last year, so I haven't checked to see the influence of this photograph, but you can be assured that the Catholic Church, at least the Pope, has an interest in the use of new media. By the way, the Vatican has now a Facebook page and is using all these social networks as well. You have no monopoly over social networking, by the way. This is an illustration of what the next generation of our laptop would look like. And our interest is basically to create a new market, not necessarily to sell our laptops. So we have a social obligation to try to keep the companies focused on lowering the price of access devices. And we believe that if we actually went away, the companies would go back to basically selling more expensive laptops because their shareholders don't like a business model of selling cheap laptops to a lot of people. They prefer to sell fewer laptops to more expensive laptops to fewer consumers. The same thing is happening in the area of health with the emergence of mobile health, largely because a large proportion of healthcare is in fact associated with the management of healthcare information. And we're starting to see basically improvement of various technologies, especially in the diagnostic field, that are IT-based, where IT is the platform. And one example, this is something I've been associated with a little bit with colleagues of mine at the Harvard Medical School. This is an ultrasound equipment about 10 years ago, it cost roughly $20,000. And so it was inaccessible for most developing countries, certainly for most African countries, you find this equipment only in major hospitals. At least that's where you found them. And so 5 years ago, a company in Seattle developed this initially for the military. It's a ruggedized ultrasound equipment you could put in your backpack and essentially take it anywhere. And I was working with colleagues of mine to try to figure out how to get these units into African hospitals. And just before we made a commitment, a colleague of mine called me up and said, don't make that commitment. There's actually a major improvement in the technology that is coming along that is smaller and cheaper. And indeed, this is as of March this year, FDA approved this Australian design technology, which is a very small ultrasound unit, which you plug into the computer and just read the images. And I was really excited about this one, and I got another phone call saying, no, don't get too excited. This costs about $2,000, that somebody has developed something that is likely to cost $100. And there it is, developed by engineers, electronic engineers, at the University of Washington in St. Louis, where the image is transmitted onto a cell phone. And essentially, if the doctor can't interpret the image, the doctor will just simply send you back a text message saying, please do it again. This is all personal diagnosis. Now, you can actually tell that these two gentlemen are not medical doctors, because if they were, they would know very well not to look for pregnancy right there. Now, let me just bring this to a close and then we can have a discussion. In addition to all these emerging possibilities, one other very important development has been the growing recognition on the part of African leaders at the highest level possible of the importance of investment in technological infrastructure in general and more specifically in information and communications technologies. I had the benefit of working with many of them to help them prepare for a summit. They held a summit of all African presidents in February 2007, and I had worked with them for about 2 years before then, just trying to figure out what could go into their declarations and getting to understand how they were thinking about the role of science and technology in development. And I was very surprised, delightedly surprised, to find out that they had very clear visions on how advances in digital media, in specifically, and science and technology in general, could transform their economies. Their biggest question wasn't what needed to be done, but how to do it. The other thing that I found really interesting is that they consistently connected it with the role of the private sector, which is the entrepreneurial functions. And a lot of it was driven by their knowledge of how cell phones had influenced society. So they were thinking in terms of metaphors. They would ask me, what's the equivalent of the cell phone in transportation, in energy, in water supply? They kind of as an analogy. They use the cell phone not as a technology, but as an analogy of how you think about the rapid rate at which emerging technologies could transform society. I'll give you just examples of a few of them. And this is also leading to them rethinking about their own roles as presidents. They are not just sitting there looking fancy. They are actually really seriously thinking about how you coordinate between different actors, especially creating fostering interactions between government, academia, and business, having a real function, because they have the political capital to coordinate other players, and they see themselves as really sitting, having an office that could play an entrepreneurial function by helping to identify emerging opportunities, assess them, take advantage of them, and stimulate the creation of enterprises. And there are a few African presidents that stand out. The first one being President Kagame of Rwanda, who, in fact, has had until recently, actually continues to have in his own office, in the office of the president, a minister responsible for science, technology, and telecommunications. This is like the most advanced and most visionary in recognizing the power of telecommunications generally, and the digital media in particular, in economic transformation, to a point where he had a full minister in his office just advising him on what to do. And he has defined his country as a leader on the continent in terms of advancing the use of telecoms in development. Rwanda was the first country to make a commitment to basically wire the entire country with the fiber optic cables, even long before the undersea cables landed, just using satellite access. This is the president of Tanzania at the launching of the SEACOM cable in July last year, and I was very surprised to see the quality and the perceptive ideas that he had about how access to broadband internet was going to transform the continent. And he explained to me in great detail how this would actually work. And after that, his special assistant turned over to me and said, "I'm so glad that you really listened very carefully to him, because the president has been spending a lot of time educating himself about this technology." And it's very clear in the way he spoke about the impact of the technology that he, not only was he persuaded about its long-term implications, but understood what it meant to be connected to high-speed internet. And we have other presidents. It's the president of Senegal, President Wade, who has been very interested in a bridging of the digital divide and argues very strongly about the importance of ensuring that especially young people in the country have access computers. So we are starting to see examples of leaders who are championing the integration of Africa into the global economy, but also looking at it as a process of creating entrepreneurial opportunities, not just being connected, but in fact opening up opportunities through which access to knowledge could lead to the creation of new enterprises. This is one of my favorite African presidents, the president of Malawi, who continues to be also the country's minister for agriculture. Again, he chose to occupy that office because of the important role that a president plays in integrating and coordinating between different ministries. When he took over the leadership, the country was literally starving, and introduced some very basic measures, which were like basically saying, instead of subsidizing consumers in urban areas, how about subsidizing farmers? And when he did that, it had a huge impact in boosting food production and lowering the cost of the price of food, which benefited both the farmers and urban consumers. But to do that, he had to intervene in a lot of different ministries as a president. And he was very widely accused of being dictatorial, amassing too much power. But that's the only way he could actually do it. And he got reelected recently. And when he did, he retained the agriculture portfolio. There are other complementary measures in addition to telecoms, with the major investments, especially in road networks. There's major improvements in road networks. And so the idea of infrastructure as a foundation for economic transformation in this country is now fully acknowledged by many of the leaders, and the question is just how to actually do it. And the other area that surprised me a little bit is the emergence of new universities that are focusing on training people in telecoms, the telecom sector. And these are universities that are not under the Ministry of Education. They fall under the Ministry of Telecoms. And there are four important examples. The first one is the Nile University in Egypt, which was created specifically to make sure that the country can train young people who understand the frontiers of telecoms technologies, but also are connected to the private sector. And by doing it under the Ministry of Telecoms, you have a better chance to connect to the private sector than if you did it under the classical Ministry of Education. This approach was subsequently followed by Ghana, which created the Ghana University of Telecoms. And as of December last year, Kenya created a multimedia university, which is also under the Minister of Telecoms. And in a couple of years, Nigeria will create a University of Telecoms, which is also under the Ministry of Telecoms, as opposed to being under the Ministry of Education. These are very fundamental reforms with a huge political debate, because the ministries of education look at this as eroding these trends, as eroding their power. But it's being driven by people in these ministries who believe strongly that the way forward is to tap into emerging technologies and connect them with the business community. And you have a better chance of doing that if you are working with the Minister of Telecoms rather than the Ministry of Education. And I have also been pursuing, in fact, similar, not just advocating it, which I've been doing with the heads of state in various places, but I've been working with colleagues to set up an Institute of Science and Technology called the Victoria Institute of Science and Technology, which is located in a small township of actually the third largest city in Kenya, but started off as I don't want to say a joke, but an idea in my house on Lake Victoria, where we said, I have this house and I don't actually use it because I live in Boston. I only go there during the summer. I said, why don't we just create an institute so that young people could spend time there learning about new technologies? It was a purely family affair. People would ask me, who is going to run your institute? I say, you know, I have already appointed a chancellor to run the institute. They say, who is the chancellor? I say, the chancellor is my mother. And who is the chief executive? I say, oh, the chief executive is my sister. Within a short period, it had a huge impact on getting some of my colleagues and friends in government to really start thinking seriously about responding to this, to the challenge. We now have a 10,000 square foot in the city of Kisumu, where we already have students, in fact, operating from there. And it's a very simple idea. We don't admit students. We are co-located with an existing university, so we admit ideas, so that if students have an idea they want to turn into a business, they just cross the corridor and come to the institute, and then we work with them to develop those ideas into business plans and connect them to mentors and business community. The chairman of the board of trustees also happens to be the president of the largest commercial bank in Kenya, who has a real interest in seeing the emergence of technology-based enterprises. Very similar, in fact, to the way you visualize your operations here. It's not accidental that I'm coming here every 6 months, because we're just really like-minded in the way we think about the role of technology in economic transformation. This was at the launching of this is after the construction. This summer I went with two volunteers who helped to train the first generation of trainers. I'm showing this because I'm also in the business of recruiting. If you are interested in spending the summer somewhere in Africa, this is a place to think of. Or if you have an idea you want to test out, a technology platform, we are totally open to those ideas. I have right now colleagues of mine who, from the Harvard Medical School, who are in Kisumu as we speak, helping to develop a medical technology unit within the institute. Lastly, this is all people ask me, do you think it will ever work? Or are you just dreaming? As my response is that you really have to take some risks. And this is what entrepreneurship is all about. It's about risk taking. And every time I show this to my colleagues, mostly people in the legal profession, they say, this zebra is really stupid. At the very least, it should be wearing a helmet. And the consensus in most places is that the zebra really shouldn't be on that motorbike. And when I show this to friends of mine in South Africa, the first question they ask is, who owns the motorbike? There are all sorts of different interpretations. But the reason why that zebra is on the motorbike is actually pretty obvious. If it wasn't on that motorbike, it would actually be in worse trouble. So my claim is that if you really are going to be serious about entrepreneurship, you have to be prepared to take some risks. And many people think that doing something is always probably exposing you to more risks than doing nothing. And this is my example that if actually this is a case where doing nothing is much more dangerous than doing something. So I want to leave you with that message just open up to questions, answers.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.